This six-lecture series, Wealth, Natural Resources, and the Environment, and the Political Concept of Monopoly, was delivered in August of 1991 as part of the fifth Jefferson School Summer Conference, The Intellectual Foundations of a Free Society 5, which was held at the University of California in San Diego. In following these lectures, it will be helpful to have available the corresponding lecture supplement, which is referred to in the lectures. If you are listening to this series as part of my full program, the supplement can be found on the CD labeled Lecture Supplements. If you did not purchase the full program, the supplement should have been sent to you either on a disk or as an email attachment file. The material on wealth, natural resources, and the environment in this lecture series is elaborated upon in chapters 2 and 3 of my book, Capitalism. The material on the political concept of monopoly is elaborated upon in the first three sections of chapter 10 of my book. Economics is the science that studies the production of wealth under a system of division of labor. That is, a system in which the individual lives by producing or helping to produce just one, or at most, a very few things, and is supplied by the labor of others with practically everything that he himself consumes. Capitalism is the essential requirement for the successful functioning of a division of labor society, indeed, ultimately, for its very existence. These are leading propositions which many of you have heard me develop at one or more other TJS conferences or seminars, and whose elaboration, at least in part, you may have read in my book, The Government Against the Economy. It is implicit in these propositions that the ultimate source of the importance of the division of labor and capitalism and of the science of economics is wealth. This is because, in the last analysis, the division of labor, capitalism, and the science of economics are all merely means to the production of wealth. The subject of wealth and the relationship of economics to wealth is surrounded with confusion. There is confusion over the meaning of wealth, doubt, even over whether economics is a science of wealth, and above all, confusion and doubt concerning the importance of wealth, that is, concerning its proper role in human life. Indeed, most philosophers and religious thinkers have held that the production of wealth serves only a lower order of needs of secondary importance, and that concern with its production beyond the minimum necessities required for the sustenance of human life is evil, immoral, and sinful by virtue of elevating low material values to the place properly reserved only for the pursuit of noble spiritual values. If these beliefs were correct, then economics would at best be a science of secondary importance, and preoccupation with it by serious thinkers would be a mark of perversity. In the face of such attitudes and confusions, it is incumbent upon economics to clarify matters, that is, to explain what wealth is, why economics is in fact a science of wealth, and above all, to justify itself by providing philosophical validation for the production of wealth being a central, continuing concern of human existence. In other words, economics must explain the role of wealth in human life beyond that of the food, clothing, and shelter required for immediate sustenance, and show how the continuing rise in the productivity of human labor, made possible by the division of labor and capitalism, serves objectively demonstrable human needs. Show indeed why there is no practical limit to man's need for wealth. Only on the basis of an objectively demonstrable need for wealth without limit is there a full and secure foundation
for the need for the division of labor and capitalism, and the continuous economic progress they bring, and for the science of economics. The absence of such understanding has been a major precondition for the success of all movements seeking to limit the individual's acquisition of wealth, from sumptuary laws to progressive income taxation to socialism, and now, most recently, to environmentalism. Thus, I will now turn to an explanation of why, of what wealth is, why economics is a science of wealth, and why there is an objectively demonstrable human need for wealth without limit. After I have done this, I will show tomorrow morning why the continuous increase in the supply of wealth that the division of labor and capitalism make possible is not prevented by any lack of natural resources. Indeed, I will show how, in a very real sense, consistent with the nature of wealth, natural resources are themselves a human creation, and that their supply is increased as part of the very same process that increases the supply of ordinary products. The demonstration that there is no inherent limitation of natural resources as an obstacle to economic progress will constitute the bridge to my critique of environmentalism. Wealth is material goods made by man. It is houses and automobiles, piles of lumber and bars of copper, steel mills and pipelines, foodstuffs and clothing. It is also land and natural resources in the ground, insofar as man has made them usable and accessible. Man, of course, does not make the material stuff of land and natural resources, but he certainly does create their character as wealth, as I will explain later. Atmospheric air, sunlight, rainfall, and wind are also material goods. But insofar as they come to us automatically, without any need for labor on our part to cause their existence or our benefit from them, they are outside the province of economic activity and of economics. They are free goods, nature-given conditions that automatically benefit us. Economics deals only with those goods which are the object of economic activity, that is, which man needs to produce in some sense, goods whose existence or beneficial relationship to his well-being he needs to cause in his capacity as a thinking being, that is, on whose behalf he must expend labor. Such goods are economic goods. In saying that wealth is goods, I refer only to economic goods. I exclude free goods. Some implications of the fact that wealth consists of goods must be named. Wealth is not at all synonymous with money or monetary value. The wealth produced in an economic system and the total monetary value of that wealth are separate and distinct phenomena. The one can increase without the other. More wealth can exist totally apart from more money. More wealth produced in the form of ordinary commodities, like steel, sugar, automobiles, and so on, without any increase in the supply of money, is nonetheless more wealth. But in such circumstances, it results in correspondingly lower prices and no increase in the total monetary value of commodities. By the same token, more money and more monetary value can exist totally apart from more wealth. This happens almost every day under a system of paper money, where the supply of money is determined by the wishes of the government, irrespective of the supply of goods. In such circumstances, the effect of the additional money is simply to raise prices. A connection between money and wealth would exist only if money consisted of gold or silver. Even then, it would be a highly imperfect connection. Under such circumstances, an increase in the supply of gold or silver would constitute both an increase in the supply of money and an increase in the supply of wealth, insofar as more gold and silver, in their capacity as industrial materials, meant more wealth. A further connection would exist insofar as increases in the supply of money under such circumstances tended to exist as the byproduct of general improvements in the ability to produce. That is, insofar as a larger supply of gold or silver was the result of improvements in machinery, transportation, and so forth, having wider application than merely to the mining of the precious metals. In reality, all the popular measures of the production of wealth, expressed in terms of totals of money, such as gross national product, GNP, and national income, are nothing but indicators of the quantity of money, not the physical volume of goods produced. Stocks, bonds, and bank deposits are also not wealth. They are claims to wealth, to the plant and equipment and inventories of firms issuing the stocks or bonds or borrowing from the banks, to the houses or automobiles of the consumers who have borrowed, or in the case of unsecured loans, to the equivalent of the goods that would otherwise be purchasable by the borrowers with their incomes. The meaning of wealth depends on the meaning of goods. Following Karl Menger, the founder of the Austrian School of Economics, I define goods, this is economic goods, as things which are recognized as capable of satisfying human needs and over which one has sufficient command gainfully to direct them to the satisfaction of one's needs. Things which are recognized as capable of satisfying human needs and over which one has sufficient command gainfully to direct them to the satisfaction of one's needs. Menger, I have to point out, did not think it necessary to include the qualification gainfully in his discussion of sufficient command over things. In other words, goods are things actually capable of benefiting us, that is, of doing us personal good. Our wealth is the collection of material goods which we possess or against which we hold enforceable claims. Stocks, bonds, and bank deposits, of course, are such claims. Things which have the power to satisfy our needs, but which we do not recognize as possessing that power, which we do not know possess that power, are not goods and do not form part of our wealth. For example, before the second half of the 19th century, petroleum was not a good. Before the 20th century, uranium was not a good. People did not know the beneficial properties of petroleum or uranium, and thus did not know how to use them for anything. Thus, at the time, such things could do them no actual good, and were therefore not goods and not part of wealth. The only circumstance in which a thing could do us good without our being aware of its beneficial properties, and thus without our having to take action based on such awareness, would be if its benefit came to us automatically, that is, if it were a free good. For a thing to be an economic good, it is essential that we possess awareness of its beneficial properties. In the same way, even if technological knowledge exists concerning the usefulness of a given type of material or a given type of mineral, all of the specific deposits of the mineral, which are as yet undiscovered, are not goods and do not constitute wealth. They too can do us no actual good in such a case. Further, things are not goods and do not constitute wealth, whose useful properties and specific locations are known, but over which we lack sufficient command to direct them to the satisfaction of our needs. For example, iron on Mars, or even 50 miles down in the Earth, is not a good and not wealth, even if we are aware of its specific location, given our present inability to gain access to it. By the same token, water in the United States is not a good to someone wandering in the Sahara. Manufactured products, too, are not goods to those who have no knowledge of their existence or cannot gain access to them. Finally, things are not goods and do not constitute wealth, even if their useful properties and specific locations are known, and even if we have sufficient command over them to direct them to the satisfaction of our needs, if we cannot gainfully direct them to the satisfaction of our needs. For example, vast stretches of land in the United States, which could be used to grow crops if someone decided to do so, are not actually goods and not wealth, because their potential could be exploited only by withdrawing capital and labor from other employments where the product of that capital and labor is greater. The use of such land to grow crops would thus not achieve our actual good, all things considered, but would inflict a loss. Thus, such land does not constitute a good and is not part of wealth. It is possible, of course, that such things, presently not goods, could someday become goods and thus wealth, if, for example, the costs of exploiting them could be reduced, or if a growing population provided labor and capital that had no better alternatives to which to be applied. To some extent, such things may be valued as goods and count as wealth in the present, in anticipation of their being able to accomplish actual good in the future. Just as the beneficial properties of things can fail to be recognized, it sometimes happens that beneficial properties are ascribed to things which do not in fact possess them, such as the beneficial properties some people ascribe to rabbit's feet, tarot cards, and so on. We can join with Menger in characterizing such things as imaginary goods. It is not necessary, however, for economics to devote any special consideration to such goods beyond acknowledging the fact of their existence. This is both because they constitute unimportant exceptions and because most of the economic principles that apply to such goods, such as the laws of price determination, are the same as that apply to genuine goods. Again, following Menger, we can divide goods into various orders, corresponding to their closeness to or remoteness from the satisfaction of our needs and wants. Goods that stand in a direct causal relationship to the satisfaction of our needs and wants can be described as goods of the first order. These are the things that benefit us directly and that are therefore directly good. For example, the food we eat, the clothes we wear. Those goods, in turn, that are necessary to the production of goods of the first order can be described as goods of the second order. For example, the ingredients and implements required to prepare a meal, the cloth, sewing machines, and thread required to produce clothes. Similarly, those goods that are necessary to the production of goods of the second order can be described as goods of the third order, and so on. The advantage of this terminology is that it highlights the fact that the source of the goods character of things is ultimately within us. Goods derive their character as goods by virtue of their ability to benefit human beings. Goods character radiates outward from people to things and touches first those goods which we categorize as goods of the first order, second, those which we categorize as goods touches first those goods which we categorize as goods of the first order, second, those which we categorize as goods of the second order, and so on. It should be apparent that the concept of economic goods is fully consistent with Ayn Rand's description of the good philosophically as an aspect of reality in relation to man. The fact that economics is a science of wealth was taken for granted by the classical economists in the 19th century. Economics' focus on wealth has been challenged in the 20th century, however, and a large majority of economists now downplays its special importance in the subject. One challenge is constituted by the frequent assertion that our economy has become a service economy rather than an economy which concentrates on the production of goods. The basis of this assertion is the fact that more than half of the working population is now employed in rendering services rather than producing goods. This service economy argument against the focus on wealth is superficial for the following reason. Not only are agriculture, mining, construction, and manufacturing all engaged in the production of goods, but also all of the so-called service industries center on goods. Retailing and wholesaling, service industries, are the retailing and wholesaling of goods. Cleaning, repair, and maintenance services are the cleaning, repair, and maintenance of goods. Transportation and communications are largely transportation of and communications concerning goods. Banking, finance, insurance, and advertising are services performed overwhelmingly in connection with facilitating the production, distribution, or ownership of goods. Those services that are performed not as auxiliaries to the production, distribution, or ownership of goods, services such as passenger airline travel for vacationers, personal communications, personal medical, legal, or grooming services, vitally depend on goods in their rendition. There could be no passenger airline travel without airplanes and airports, no telephone service without telephones and telephone exchanges, and so forth. What makes the rendition of personal services fall within the sphere of economics is the fact that the providers of such services render them for the purpose of acquiring wealth. As I have shown at a previous TJS conference, in a division of labor society, this refers to the rendition of such services for the purpose of earning money. Thus, the services of personal physicians, personal attorneys, barbers, and the like come within the sphere of economics insofar as they are performed for money, which is the means by which these parties obtain wealth in a division of labor society. It is true, of course, that there could be no wealth without the rendition of services, above all the performance of labor. But this does not give services an equal position with wealth in economics. Although economics is concerned with services, it is so only insofar as they are necessary to the production, enjoyment, or acquisition of wealth, or depend on the use of wealth. Economics is not at all concerned with the rendition of services apart from their connection with wealth. For example, when two people hold an interesting conversation, they are rendering a service to each other. But economics is not concerned with activities of this nature except insofar as they can be connected with wealth. It could be argued that the direct exchange of services for services also sometimes falls within the sphere of economics. For example, an exchange of French lessons for mathematics lessons, in which the rendition of each service is performed as the conscious, explicitly agreed upon requirement of receiving the other. Even in such cases, what brings the rendition of the service within the purview of economics is ultimately a connection to wealth. This is so because what makes exchange itself a vital economic phenomenon central to the studies of economics is the fact that in a division of labor society, the production and enjoyment of wealth requires it as the means of bringing goods from their producers to their consumers. In the absence of a division of labor in the production of wealth, exchange would be a relatively infrequent and unimportant phenomenon. It is only the fact that the production of wealth takes place under a division of labor, which makes exchange the vital economic phenomenon it is, and thus permits consideration of the exchange of services for services as falling within the domain of economics. The second challenge to economics' focus on wealth is the mistaken claim that economics is a science of choices rather than a science of wealth, a science which studies the, quote, allocation of scarce means among competing ends, unquote. This contention rests on a logical fallacy. It does not see that what gives rise to economic study of choices and its concern with the allocation of scarce means among competing ends is the fact that people have a virtually limitless need for wealth, but only a limited capability of satisfying that need at any given time. Thus, people must choose which aspects of their need for wealth are to be satisfied and which are not. Economics studies the determinants of human choice only insofar as they concern choices of how to spend incomes that are of necessity limited, and only insofar as they affect the attraction of capital and labor to the production of some goods rather than other goods. In other words, it studies the issue of choices for no other reason than that it is necessary to do so as part of its study of the production of wealth under a system of division of labor. To claim that economics is, on this account, a science of human choices rather than of wealth is to confuse an aspect of the science with its totality. To adopt this view is to be led to ignore all the really crucial matters that economics deals with and to seek esoteric extensions of the subject that have nothing whatever to do with its actual nature. Fortunately, those who adopt this view are highly inconsistent in its application and generally continue to devote most of their attention to the serious business of economics and leave the alleged necessity of extending the subject beyond the domain of wealth as a task to be carried out in the indefinite future. Regrettably, this criticism applies to the great von Mises and his efforts to portray economics as merely the, quote, hitherto best developed part, unquote, of an allegedly wider science of human action known as praxeology. I turn now to the proposition that man's need for wealth has no practical limit. The basis of this proposition is the fact that man possesses the faculty of reason. The possession of this faculty radically enlarges both the scope of man's needs and capacities in comparison with those of any other living entity, and at the same time makes possible continuous improvement of the satisfaction of his needs and the exercise of his capacities. Considered abstractly, man's possession of reason gives him the potential for a limitless range of knowledge and awareness, and thus for a limitless range of action and experience. Man's mind can grasp the existence both of subatomic particles and of galaxies, and of everything in between. It observes all manner of patterns and of similarities and differences, of which no other form of consciousness is capable. Thus, the potential is created for man to act over a range extending from the subatomic level to the remotest reaches of outer space, and to experience all that his mind enables him to discern and enjoy in the totality of the universe. Material goods, wealth, are the physical means both of acting in the world, for example, automobiles and airplanes, tools and machines of all kinds, and of enjoying the experiences of which man is capable. For example, in addition to many of the goods in the preceding category, works of art and sculpture, landscape grounds and gardens, beautiful homes and furniture. They are the instrumentalities of man's action and objects of his contemplation. That is the role of material goods. The potential of a limitless range of action and experience implies a limitless need for wealth as the means of achieving this potential. Man needs wealth without limit if he is to fulfill his limitless potential as a rational being in physical reality. This abstract principle can be illustrated in a wide variety of forms, starting with the contribution of additional wealth to the improved satisfaction of man's elementary needs for nutrition and health. Because man possesses reason and is thus able to abstract, form concepts, and think conceptually, his mind is able to grasp connections spanning generations and continents between his material well-being and the physical state of the world. Thus, for man functioning on the conceptual level, the satisfaction just of the needs for nutrition and health implies a practically limitless need and desire for wealth in the form of canning and freezing facilities, a modern transportation and communications system, a farm equipment industry, and everything that is necessary to the existence of these things, such as the steel, oil, and coal industries, the transportation and communications equipment industries, and so on. All such wealth is necessary to an adequate quantity and sufficient variety of food to meet man's nutritional needs. Likewise, man's need for health further implies a need not only for medicines, hospitals, and all manner of diagnostic and therapeutic equipment and everything necessary to their existence, but extends even to such seemingly unrelated things as automobiles and space travel. The former made possible the ability of people to live in the fresh air of the suburbs and also the modern ambulance. The latter holds out such things as the possibility of recuperation from heart disease in an environment of reduced gravity. Reason gives man the ability to use wealth progressively to enhance the exercise of the capacities he shares in common with lesser species. For example, man shares with animals the capacity for locomotion. Animals can do no better than rely on their unaided legs. Man domesticates the horse, the elephant, and the camel. He produces shoes and builds roads, rafts, and sailing vessels. He goes further and invents the railroad, the steamship, and the automobile, and then the airplane and the rocket ship. Similarly, man shares with the animals the capacity to see and hear. Animals can do no more than rely on their unaided eyes and ears, but man produces telescopes, microscopes, and stethoscopes, television sets and radios, X-ray machines and phonographs, eyeglasses and hearing aids, motion pictures and tape recorders. As noted, the fact that man is the rational being also gives him a wider range of capacities than is possessed by any of the lesser species. Because man is the rational being, he is able to pursue such activities as music, art, science, and athletics. He is able to form relationships with others, which are maintained even though the parties may be separated by great distances and for long intervals of time. It is the nature of man's brain that enables him to integrate separate sounds into harmonies and melodies, to grasp representations and thus the meaning of a painting, to pursue science, to follow the system of rules of a game of sport, and to maintain an awareness of others from whom he is separated by time and distance. These are feats of which an animal's brain is incapable. In the pursuit of all of these additional activities made possible by the possession of reason, wealth is either absolutely indispensable or, at a minimum, enormously contributes to the performance and enjoyment of the activity. Wealth contributes to music when it takes the form of musical instruments, music books and scores, concert halls and conservatories, radios, phonographs, and tape recorders. If music were deprived of the existence of these forms of wealth, the activity would be reduced to the unaided, untrained, and largely unheard singing of the human voice. In the absence of wealth in the form of brushes, paints, and canvases, of museums, schools, and books of art, art would be reduced to primitive drawings on the walls of caves. In the absence of wealth in the form of scientific equipment, laboratories, universities, and libraries, science could not be pursued. In the absence of wealth in the form of playing fields, athletic equipment, stadiums, and radio and television sets, athletic events and the enjoyment derived from them would suffer a radical decline. In the absence of wealth in the form of pens and paper, post offices, telephones, automobiles, railroads, ships, and planes, friendships and other human relationships could not be maintained over long distances. On the basis of these observations, it is obvious that the ancient prejudice that man's desire for wealth serves his lower needs is absurd. Wealth is the material means of carrying on virtually every human activity and of serving virtually all of man's needs. It is man's means of acting in accordance with his human potential. Moreover, even the wealth that does serve man's lower needs, such as presumably his needs for nutrition and elimination, also reflects his nature as a rational being in ways beyond those already described. When man serves his lower needs, he does so in a manner that is unique to him, in a manner that reflects the distinctive nature of his consciousness. For example, when man eats, he does not do so in the manner of an animal indifferent to his surroundings. On the contrary, he desires such things as tables and chairs, table linen, china, silverware, and so on. He is also highly sensitive to the preparation of his food and to the combinations in which it is served. When man eliminates, he desires the existence of such things as indoor plumbing and privacy. In such activities, the nature of man's consciousness requires the incorporation of aesthetic psychological elements into the satisfaction of what in animals are merely physical needs. For man, at least in his waking hours, there is probably no such thing as a purely physical need. Man's physical needs are intimately connected with his psychology as a rational being. As a being aware of such things as patterns and harmonies and dissonances in shapes, sounds, and colors, and possessing the need to organize his activities and control the functions of his body. In everything he does, man can be aware of his own emotional responses and can distinguish between aesthetic elements which enable him to have a more enjoyable or a less enjoyable emotional response. Thus, the aesthetic element enters into the satisfaction of virtually all of man's needs. It leads him to desire not just clothing and shelter, but clothing and shelter with style and beauty. It leads him to desire not just transportation, but automobiles with chrome trim and white wall tires. Matters of design and appearance feature prominently in all consumers' goods where men are free to choose. Closely related to man's need for aesthetic satisfaction is his need for novelty and variety, which need also emanates from the rational nature of his consciousness. The lower animals do not become bored with the repetition of the same routine. Man does. The nature of man's consciousness enables him to appreciate differences of a kind of which animals show no apparent awareness, and seems to require that he periodically experience such differences. Thus, whereas animals are content to eat the same food day in and day out, man requires a variety of food. Man experiences a sense of intellectual refreshment when he breaks his routine and takes a vacation or a weekend off. He also experiences a sense of intellectual refreshment in the introduction and possession of new goods and with the coming of style changes. Thus, the appearance of almost every new gadget is an occasion for a kind of excitement. It is a thrill for a rational consciousness to see such new products appear each in its day as automobiles, airplanes, refrigerators, radios, television sets, pocket calculators, computers, and so on. The purchase of such goods is almost always an occasion for special pleasure because it provides something new and valuable to experience. Even the replacement purchases of such goods are usually a source of pleasure because further improvements have usually been made in them and because of style changes. Changes in style, whether in automobiles, clothing, or furniture, are a source of intellectual refreshment and pleasure because they provide a sense of the new and different. It must be stressed that man's desire for novelty and variety stands in the service of his life. The principle is very similar to that of the pursuit of scientific knowledge, where the motive is curiosity and the effect is all manner of practical applications that could not have been foreseen in advance. In just this way, people originally desired automobiles not as a practical means of transportation, but as an object of amusement. Yet this desire led to the growth of the automobile industry and to the transformation of the economic system. A similar course of development occurred in the case of electric light and power, and telephones and television sets, and now seems to be underway in the case of home and personal computers. Even if no practical applications ever result directly from the things desired, their being desired produces practical results. For example, a great industrialist's motive in earning additional millions on top of those he already has may be merely to add to his collection of fine paintings and statues. But in pursuing this motive, the industrialist is led to introduce products and methods of production that enable the average person to obtain such things as more and better food, clothing, and transportation. Man's life gains incalculably from the fact that his activities are not limited to the, quote, practical, unquote, but are undertaken largely for the sheer pleasure of experiencing the new and the different, and the corresponding expansion of his own powers required to accomplish it. For this leads him to do things that have practical results which it would otherwise be impossible for him to obtain. In effect, reason serves man's life in being free to serve itself. Although man's life may not need every particular object of his desire for novelty and variety, it very much does need the existence of his desire for novelty and variety. On the basis of an objectively limitless need for wealth, there is no limit to man's desire for wealth. The occasional cases that exist of individuals in whom the desire for additional wealth is totally repressed are comparable in their frequency and significance to the cases of individuals in whom sexual desire is totally repressed. These cases are rare indeed. Even medieval monks, for example, thoroughly committed to the doctrine of asceticism, were torn by the temptation for material things. The truth lies with Adam Smith, who observed, quote, "The desire of food is limited in every man by the narrow capacity of the human stomach. But the desire of the conveniences and ornaments of building, dress, equipage, and household furniture seems to have no limit or certain boundary." To translate Smith's observation into contemporary terms, we can observe as the overwhelming norm such things as that the man who has no automobile would like to be able to afford one. The man who has an automobile would like to be able to afford a newer, better one. The man who has one or more new automobiles of the highest quality would like to be able to afford a yacht or a plane. If he is rich enough to afford both a yacht and a plane, then he would like to be able to afford a yacht on which the plane can land. And so on. Similarly, the man who has a small house or apartment would like to be able to afford a larger one. If he has a large house or apartment, he would like a more luxurious one, perhaps with a swimming pool or tennis court or both, and with finely landscaped grounds. And he would probably like to have more than one house or apartment, perhaps a hunting lodge in Maine, a winter home in Palm Beach, an apartment in Paris, or indeed all three of them. The more one has, the more one wants. The fact that both the need and the desire for additional wealth are limitless for all practical purposes does not mean, however, that people automatically act to satisfy that need and desire. It is certainly possible for the need and desire for additional wealth to fail to result in the production of additional wealth, let alone in continuous economic progress. Indeed, history and most of the world around us are characterized by stagnation and poverty. The mere possession of a need or a desire is never sufficient to ensure that the need or desire will be satisfied. In the absence of the influence of a rational philosophy establishing limited government and economic freedom, and inculcating such convictions as that the material world has both reality and primacy, that it is intelligible, and that hard work pays, man is not able to devote himself sufficiently to the production of wealth. In such conditions, man desires more wealth than he possesses, but his desire is not strong enough or consistent enough to enable him actually to go and produce additional wealth. And if it is strong enough to induce him to increase his production, he is again and again stopped from doing so by the initiation of physical force by others. Even when the barrier of physical force temporarily relaxes and some individuals are able to make some improvements, the absence of a rational philosophy precludes the development of science. It also precludes the establishment of sufficient freedom to make possible the development of the division of labor and the other capitalistic institutions necessary to the continuous increase in wealth. As a result, despite the existence of both a need and desire for additional wealth on the part of those affected, we witness such phenomena as masses of people dying of starvation, yet unable, indeed sometimes even unwilling, to expend the effort to produce additional food. We witness primitive people delighted with the gift of mirrors and trinkets of all kinds, not to mention transistor radios and bicycles, yet willing to go on living under essentially the same conditions as their remotest ancestors. The fact that the need and desire for wealth are limitless does not mean that when people devote themselves to satisfying that need and desire, as in the nations of modern capitalism, they go through life with a sense of endless frustration, seeking more than they can ever hope to obtain. The normal man, if he lacks an automobile, does not actively desire a yacht. He actively desires merely an automobile. His desire for a yacht lies dormant until such time as he already has acquired one or more high-quality automobiles. The limitless desire for wealth, in other words, becomes active only step by step. It manifests itself in an active desire for things that are merely one or two steps beyond our reach at the moment. It leads us to exert ourselves and extend our reach. And then, as we succeed, desires previously dormant become active, or totally new desires are formed, and we are led to exert ourselves and extend our reach still further. Thus, the limitless desire for wealth impels us steadily to advance. Oriental philosophy and some schools of thought in the contemporary Western world claim that the fact that our desires will always be a step ahead of our possessions shows the futility of our efforts, that instead we should seek to rid ourselves of our desires and be content forever with some minimum of wealth. Such teachings are utterly mistaken, and their influence helps to account for the stagnation and poverty that exist in the world. They view the excess of our desires over our possessions as a source of discontent and unhappiness. Actually, this excess is the root of our ambitiousness and our rising to meet challenges. It is what impels us to progress, and as such, is an essential element of our happiness. It should be realized that as rational beings, we are also progressive beings. Progress is the corollary of the continuous application of reason. Any individual who continues to use reason, who continues to think, necessarily comes to know more and more, and thus to be capable of accomplishing more and more. If a society is characterized by continuous thinking from generation to generation, and if its educational system works, that is, if it succeeds in transmitting to the rising generation the essentials of the knowledge discovered by all the preceding generations, then the general body of knowledge in the society is progressive, and thus the society as a whole is capable of accomplishing more and more. Progress is the natural result of the use of reason as a constant. If our happiness depends on living in accordance with our nature as rational beings, then our happiness and progress are inseparably connected. The fact that our desires will always be ahead of our ability to satisfy them is not a cause of unhappiness. It is the inducement to the steady exercise of our reason, to our living in accordance with our nature, which is indispensable to our happiness. Our happiness does not come from the existence of desires satisfied, but from the steady upward climb itself. A process of continuing to think and solve problems and to become capable of accomplishing more and more. In other words, progress is a source of happiness. In the lives of scientists, inventors, businessmen, engineers, and managers, progress is the obvious focal point of thinking, planning, and problem solving. It is also what necessitates that the average worker make himself capable of continuing to think and learn throughout his life, so that he can acquire the new skills necessary to adapt to the changing requirements of production. Thus, progress is what helps to elevate even the average man of modern Western civilization into a thinking, literate being, possessing an intellectual life incomparably superior to that of previous eras. If happiness depends on the possession of a sound, active mind, progress fosters happiness. A further aspect of the connection between progress, reason, and happiness must be mentioned. As rational beings, we are able to be aware of the future. The future has reality for us in the present. To be able to look forward to a better future enables us to bear considerable hardship in the present without complaint, even cheerfully. But to look forward to a future of unrelieved hardship, or worse, a future that holds out the prospect of even greater hardship, makes hardship in the present more difficult, if not impossible, to bear. Indeed, the prospect of impoverishment in the future deprives one of the ability to derive pleasure even from the possession of substantial material wealth in the present. For the shadow of such a future must hang over whatever enjoyment one might have in the present. Thus, the prospect of progress, as well as the process of achieving it, contributes to our happiness. According to the widely held doctrines of cultural relativism and conspicuous consumption, the concept of economic progress can have no objective meaning. These doctrines hold, for example, that our preference for automobiles over horses, or for radios and television sets over jungle tom-toms, is a matter of social and cultural conditioning. It is allegedly the result only of the fact that in this particular culture it happens to have been instilled in people for no really good reason that it is desirable to own goods such as automobiles and television sets. Accordingly, people supposedly want to own such goods not because it really is desirable to own them in any objective sense, but merely that they may conform to what is expected of them in this culture. They allegedly want to own them as a source of prestige in the eyes of others. The essential meaning of these doctrines can be grasped by realizing that what they imply is that people want to own television sets not because they want to watch the television sets, but because they want to be seen watching them, or because they were told to do so by the advertisers. Not the actual consumption of goods is important, we are told, but the conspicuousness of their consumption. Thus, the only real significance of television sets or any of the other gadgets of capitalist society is supposed to be their significance in the eyes of others. In a different culture, people allegedly derive equal satisfaction from appearing before others with a ring through their nose. And in the society of the future, or at least as many people conceived the future until very recently, they will allegedly do so by wearing a chest full of medals proclaiming them as heroes of socialist labor. Thus, according to these doctrines, there is no reason to believe that people's preferences in a modern capitalist society are any better grounded than those of people in any other type of society, or that a modern capitalist society is in any objective sense superior to any other. There is thus allegedly no basis for believing that what has been accomplished in modern society, in modern capitalist society, is in any objective sense progress. Now, what is wrong with these doctrines is that they omit any consideration of man in relation to the physical world. For them, the most important thing in human life is the mere approval or disapproval of other people, which is thought to constitute an ultimate standard incapable of being subjected to further evaluation. But the truth is, of course, that the primary issue in human life is man's relation to the physical world. It is there and there alone that man must live or die, irrespective of the culture in which he lives. And how man succeeds in relation to the physical world provides an objective standard by which to judge the value of cultures. The examples of automobiles and television sets can serve to illustrate the point. It is not true that our preference for the automobile over the horse is arbitrary, based on nothing more than social or cultural conditioning. It is based on our nature, both as animate beings possessing the capacity of locomotion and as rational beings capable of enlarging all of our physical capacities. We call the automobile an advance over the horse by the same standard by which we call the domestication of the horse an advance over possessing merely our unaided legs, and by the same standard by which we value the possession of our legs themselves. Namely, it extends our range and power of locomotion. If the automobile were not an advance over the horse, then the horse would not be an advance over our unaided legs. And on the basis of such reasoning, the very possession of legs themselves could not be considered better than not possessing them. The automobile is an advance over the horse, therefore, for the same reason that it is better to have legs than not to have them. Similarly, we call the telegraph an advance over the tom-tom and radio an advance over the telegraph because they increase the efficacy of our sense of hearing. The one enables us to hear sounds coming from a greater distance, the other sounds from a greater distance as well as a greater range of sound. Thus, we value the radio over the telegraph and the telegraph over the tom-tom by the same standard as we value our sense of hearing itself. We call television an advance over radio for the same reason that we value the possession of eyes and ears together over the possession of ears alone. We call color television an advance over black and white for the same reason that we value normal vision over being colorblind. The advances in our goods represent extensions of our power to use our limbs, senses, and minds to accomplish results. In effect, they multiply, they magnify the power of these vital attributes of our persons. They are advances by the standard of the value of these attributes, and thus by the standard of the value of our persons. Needless to say, I'm indebted to Ayn Rand both for the general concept of an objective code of values based on man's life as the standard, and for the special application of that concept in the form of some goods being classified as being of greater philosophically objective value than others. It may be that there are cultures in which people regularly grow up incapable of appreciating the value of economic advances. It may be that in this culture there are some people who really do not understand what our advances are all about, and who see no better reason for valuing them than that of conforming to the expectations of others. The existence of such people and of such cultures proves not that our advances are not advances, but only that there are people with a gross deficiency of understanding, and cultures that are highly destructive of the capacity for understanding. This discussion has major bearing on the fact that in American society, the earning of wealth has traditionally been the leading source of prestige. The objective fact underlying such prestige is that the earning of wealth benefits one's life by enabling one to do more. Thus, it deserves to bring prestige by the standard of human life as a value. It is a great tribute to the culture of the United States that it is to such activity that it has accorded prestige. It must also be pointed out that the attempt to reverse cause and effect and to take prestige as the starting point must backfire. For example, the attempt of a socialist society to induce work by the offer of prestige rather than material incentives not only cannot succeed, but must bring the opposite of prestige to those who would be willing to work for it. To mine coal, drive a truck, harvest a field, work in a factory, to do virtually any of the run-of-the-mill jobs that occupy the bulk of the labor force for the sake of prestige would be to mark a person as nothing but a fool. He would have to be a fool to drive himself day in and day out, sweating and straining, all for the sake of nothing more than, in effect, being called a good boy. The objective superiority of the goods of modern capitalism is not called into question by the fact that in our culture, many people want to own such goods as horses, canoes, bows and arrows, and so on, and in some cases prefer units of these goods to more advanced goods serving the same needs. Such choices do not by any means necessarily mark these people as primitivists. There are conditions in which the horse is superior to the automobile, for example, where there are no roads. Similarly, canoes can navigate shallow waters that a motorized craft cannot. Also, the physical experience that a horse or canoe affords is different from that provided by an automobile or motorboat. They enable one to observe things more closely and more leisurely, for example. The desire to own such goods, even though one lives in the conditions of modern civilization, is actually nothing more than a manifestation of our limitless need for wealth. A person wants one or more automobiles as his normal means of transportation, and a horse as a further refinement, as it were, of his ability to locomote. Thus, he loads his horse into a horse trailer, hitches it to his car, or better, motor home, and drives to the edge of terrain where only horses can go. To be able to enjoy the widest possible range of pleasurable and beneficial experiences is precisely why an individual desires to obtain the greatest possible amount of wealth. But to obtain it and to have the time to enjoy it, he must be able to accomplish everything that is not itself pleasure or otherwise valued for its own sake in the shortest possible time. If, for example, what a person wants is the experience of leisurely riding along a beautiful mountain stream, then he doesn't want to waste that time using a horse to cross the country to get to the mountains. For that, he wants a motor vehicle. It, together with roads, is objectively superior to the horse as a normal means of transportation. As a direct source of enjoyment, however, there is still a need for horses, even in the conditions of a modern economy. In effect, the limitless need for wealth embraces a kind of recapitulation of the goods that were prominent in less advanced conditions. I have shown that economic progress is not a matter of arbitrary preference, but is objectively desirable, on the basis of our nature as rational beings. The goods that result are objectively improvements, and the process of acquiring them, the continuous thinking that must be done, is called for by our nature as rational beings. The objective value of economic progress implies that the cultural values that make economic progress possible are likewise objectively better than those that stand in its way. These values, of course, are the values that underlie the division of labor and capitalism. Above all, reason, science, technology, individual rights, limited government, and economic freedom, and private ownership of the means of production. In the name of being able to see, hear, move, or do anything that our senses, limbs, and minds enable us to do, in the name of being able to live as human beings, these values deserve to be upheld. Indeed, the same principle that establishes the objectivity of the economic advances of modern capitalism directly establishes the objectivity of the superiority of modern capitalist civilization as such, that is, modern Western civilization, in comparison to any other form of civilization. Here, the attribute that serves as the standard is the ability to acquire and apply knowledge. For elaboration, I refer you to my article, Education and the Racist Road to Barbarism, which is now available as a pamphlet. Of course, the claim of superiority for any given set of values encounters the opposition of a profound self-righteous hatred of the very idea of objective values. Thus, cultures may practice ritual sacrifice, cannibalism, mass expropriation, slavery, torture, and wholesale slaughter. All of this is accepted as somehow legitimate within the context of the culture concerned. Practically, the only alleged sin, the only alleged act of immorality in the world is to display contempt for such cultures and to uphold as superior the values of capitalist culture. Then one is denounced as an imperialist, racist, and virtual Nazi. It should be realized that those who take this view do not regard as the essential evil of Nazism its avowed irrationalism, its love of force and violence, and its acts of destruction and slaughter. All this they could accept, and do accept, in the case of other cultures, such as that of primitive tribes, ancient Egypt, the civilization of the Aztecs and Incas, the Middle Ages, and Soviet Russia. What they hold to be the evil of Nazism was its assertion that Nazi culture was superior to other cultures. The claim of superiority of one culture over another is the one evil in their eyes. Needless to say, of course, it is only on the basis of the recognition of objective values that one can seriously condemn Nazism, not for its absurd claims of superiority, but as a primitive, barbaric culture of the type one would expect to find among savages. While extolling the values of capitalism, I want to stress that nothing I have said or will say in these lectures or anywhere else should be taken to imply a belief on my part that contemporary Western or American culture is perfect. Far from it. Obviously, some very serious flaws mar our culture, and they have been growing. Our culture's basic flaw is its philosophic contradictions. These contradictions in the form of irrationalist doctrines, such as notably that of cultural relativism, lead it to attack its virtues. Thus, we witness the spectacle of our culture flagellating itself for its successes in science, technology, and the creation of wealth. We see the spectacle of Western intellectuals holding the most primitive and barbaric cultures as superior to their own, as they declare that all cultures are of equal value except their own, which is to be despised. The spectacle is particularly gross in regard to the culture of the United States, which in all respects but the arts is the foremost Western country. The United States is denounced by its enemies as the leader of the evil reactionary forces, the champion of monopoly capital and imperialism. Its own intellectuals join the denunciations and find nothing but evil in the history of their country and in its current policies. Yet all the flaws of the United States were flaws of being inconsistent with its own magnificent principles. Its flaw today, which is potentially deadly, is that many of its intellectual leaders had been corrupted to the point of despising those principles, above all, the principles of limited government and economic freedom, and more recently, the values of science and technology as well. Well, to summarize, this morning I explained the nature of wealth and goods and showed why economics is, as the classical economists maintained, a science of wealth. I demonstrated the existence of a human need and corresponding desire for wealth that for all practical purposes is unlimited, inasmuch as it is based on man's possession of reason. I showed that the possession of reason, in creating the potential for a virtually limitless range of knowledge and awareness, and of action and experience, creates the basis for a limitless need for wealth as the material means of acting and experiencing. I showed that wealth without practical limit is necessary to serve the entire scope of human needs and capacities, and to do so in ever-improved ways, and that the desire for wealth without limit is what impels us toward progress. I showed that progress is natural to man, the rational being, in that it is the result of his use of reason as a constant, that it is the result that follows from the transmission of knowledge from generation to generation and the contribution of fresh thinking by succeeding generations. I showed that the process of economic progress is an important source of human happiness. I demonstrated the objective nature of economic progress based on an objective standard for judging advances in goods. I demonstrated the objective superiority of a division of labor capitalist society, both as the source of objectively more advanced goods and by the standard of the ability to acquire and apply knowledge. Tomorrow, for the benefit of anyone who is familiar with economics, I will show how the existence of a limitless need for wealth is consistent with the law of diminishing marginal utility. I will also show how, under capitalism, the existence of a limitless need for wealth transforms the concept of scarcity from one whose meaning is deprivation into one whose meaning is growing abundance in the face of the fact that no matter how much men have, they desire and are free to produce still more. I will show why the process of increasing production is not limited by any inherent lack of natural resources, and why the fundamental ineradicable scarcity is strictly one of human labor, and thus why the fundamental economic problem is in fact the problem of continually increasing the productivity of human labor. In connection with my demonstration of why there is no inherent lack of natural resources, I must ask you to read the supplement I have distributed, which you all received in your packets at registration, the supplement entitled "The Growing Abundance of Natural Resources and the Wastes of Recycling." It is an excerpt from my book, The Government Against the Economy, and contains most of the substance of what I have to say on this subject and the related subject of recycling. So please be sure to read it for tomorrow. It is only about 5 normal-sized book pages in length. That will save me from having to repeat that material for the substantial portion of the audience that I think is already familiar with it. Well, thank you very much. Now I'll be glad to entertain any questions that you may have. Yes?
You said that in economics, services aren't equivalent to wealth, but can you clarify this? Because I thought that you said that that services are goods, but then you also said that that goods are wealth, but services aren't wealth.
Well, what my services as such are not wealth. Wealth is material things. Services would be in the wider category of actions rather than things. But my main point was that economics is fundamentally a science of wealth and is so despite the fact that more than half of the number of workers work in service industries. Almost all of the services are auxiliary to the production, distribution, or enjoyment of wealth. And those services which are not, such as personal medical services, come under the purview of economics by virtue of the fact that the providers provide them for the purpose of earning money. And what makes money and the phenomenon of exchange important is the fact that the division of labor is produced, that wealth is produced under a division of labor. This gentleman right here, Mr. Trzezinski.
Can you?
I'm sorry, Mr. Garmon. Excuse me. Forgive me.
You The question is, I gave Karl Menger's definition of economic goods, and the question is, to what extent do later Austrian economists such as von Mises go along with the definition? I would say, essentially they do. The one area of difference with von Mises would be that he would probably be critical sometimes of Menger talking about imaginary goods. You see, von Mises is, to put it best, very ambivalent on the subject of objective values. He often writes saying that all values are arbitrary and subjective. But I think that the great bulk of what he actually says contradicts that proposition. I think if he could be pinned down, if he could be confronted, he would not say that his preference for capitalism over socialism is an arbitrary subjective preference. He certainly doesn't write like that. He was totally dedicated to the value of capitalism in a way that one could be only in the conviction that it's absolutely objective. And also you'll find in some of his writings, notably in Socialism, some statements very, very close to objectivism. At one point, he says that it might be a sound procedure to regard the subject of ethics in a way similar to hygiene, that ethics fundamentally is an issue pertaining to the individual. And he keeps repeating the proposition, if one prefers life and health to sickness and death, then one has to support capitalism. So I think that I would say 80% he is really with us in terms even of ethics, despite his many contradictory statements. Mr. Oliver, is it?
I'm wondering how you classify a computer program. Is it good, or would you classify it as a good?
How would I classify a computer program? Would it be a good or a service or whatever? Well, the program as such, if it's in the mind of the programmer, it's simply an idea. It's not yet a good. Once it is on a diskette or it has been printed out, then it is a good. Software is goods.
Point on that, because I think your definition of wealth as material goods may unfortunately exclude this very important type of wealth, the intellectual property, the patent, the copyright, the trademark, the trade secret. These are non-material and not classified by law as goods. They are immaterial, intangible products, and that's a very important form of wealth.
All right. What is the status of ideas? Are ideas wealth? Bombaverk wrote a whole book titled, I think, Rights and Relationships in Relation to the Category of Economic Goods. I have not read very much of that book, and I'm sure he deals with this question in great depth. Ideas are the indispensable foundation of wealth. But I still would hold that wealth is material goods. And patents and copyrights have exchangeable wealth, so do stocks and bonds. The patents and the source of the exchangeable value of patents and copyrights is the fact that they make it possible for people to obtain material goods. So I don't think that they themselves are wealth. They are a claim which makes it possible to obtain actual wealth. But the actual wealth is material. I don't think in any way I belittle the importance of ideas. I stress that the foundation of wealth is man's ability to think and progress. And we are richer, you see, we are richer by virtue of the ideas being translated into material goods. Imagine one had the patents and the copyrights, but somehow they became separated from the possibility of being put into production. Let's imagine the environmentalists were to establish a law. From this day forward, all new patents must be locked up in the patent office. They cannot be applied to production. All new copyrights, you cannot publish the books. We're saving natural resources. Well, what would then happen to any possible goods character of these things? That they wouldn't exist. They derive, any value they possess is derived from their ability to contribute to the production of material things. Yeah?
Well, unless the patents and the copyrights are in material form, they can't be exchanged for anything. They're of no value. They're just an idea in somebody's head.
Yes. Now, you have to have a formula written down. Now, you have to have a stock certificate that is printed. But the thing itself, certainly it's clear. It's clearer, perhaps, in the case of the stocks and bonds, that they are not wealth. There's a sheet of paper, but you don't pay $100 for a slip of paper normally because it's the slip of paper. You do it because it's a claim to the earnings of the firm. And you're paying for the patent and copyright because it gives you the exclusive right to produce or manufacture the item. Now, the fact that the patent or copyright has a commercial value is based on the fact that it does give you an exclusive legal right. If you didn't have an exclusive legal right, you wouldn't pay for the patent or copyright. Now, the intellectual contribution that is made by the inventor or author is the same whether he has a patent or copyright or not. Now, what happens to the status of his creation when the patent or copyright comes off? Here we are. We have automobiles, and we have all of the inventions that have made the automobile possible. Now, what is the wealth? Is the wealth the automobiles, or is it the automobiles plus the various ideas that have led to the automobiles? I would say the wealth is the automobiles, the steel mills, etc., etc. The wealth is not, in addition, the ideas that made them possible. The ideas are essential, but they are not the wealth. The people are essential, but they are not the wealth. Their labor services are essential, but that is not wealth. Wealth is material goods. Edith. Why don't I say economic goods rather than goods? Because, well, the concept economic goods is used in differentiation from free goods, things which come to us as conditions of nature, like sunlight, atmospheric air, which benefit us without our having to take any conscious form of action. And I think it would be a profound mistake to lump the ideas into the category of non-economic or free goods. See, I would open up much more trouble that way if I said, well, patents and copyrights and so forth are not economic goods, then that raises the question, well, are they free goods in the category of air? The point is, they are not wealth. They are not wealth. They are not goods. They are absolutely essential to goods, but they are not goods. For example, a singer sings a song. The song is recorded. Is the singing of the song a good? The record is a good, but not the singing of the song. The idea that makes something happen, that's vital, but the wealth is the material product. Mr. Coates.
Yeah, a question about the man wanting a yacht big enough to land.
I'm sorry,
I have a question on the man wanting a yacht big enough to land his plane on.
Uh-huh.
But just as an aside, I think that previous question, maybe people are thinking that when you say ideas are not wealth, they're interpreting you to mean that ideas are not values, which is not correct.
Well, I think that's very clear.
Okay, but I think that was perhaps a source of misinterpretation by some people. But anyway, my question on the man who constantly wants something else, he gets the automobile, then he wants a better automobile, finally gets a yacht, and then he's still not satisfied, he wants a yacht big enough to land his plane on. I'm wondering, though, if I were that man, it wouldn't be realistic to me. It seems to me that my desire for wealth does have limits. At a certain point, I have enough toys to play with, and I'd rather just lie on a beach, or I have more things that I can deal with, or I want them slightly less at a certain point. So it seems that when you get to the science fiction stage where everybody has a private airplane, you know, in the 21st century,
yeah,
that there comes a point where everybody has enough, or that the amount that they want something else is decreased by what they already have.
Okay, you can say there are people who reach a point where they decide they prefer to retire rather than earn still more wealth. Well, I would say they would still like to have more wealth if they could have gotten it with less effort. When they made their wealth, they would have preferred to have made more with the same effort that they made what they have. Now, if you take someone who wants to go off to a beach or whatever, I would say even such a person, if without any greater effort on his part, could have more wealth than what he has, if there is any value of any kind in the world which could be furthered by the possession of more wealth, then he would prefer to have more wealth. Even if he feels in his own life, okay, I have all the homes I want, all the appliances, whatever, is there any further interest? Does he have any value of any kind which could be pursued further on the basis of more wealth? Does he have an interest in astronomy? Would he like more wealth to finance space research? Is he concerned with a cure for cancer? Does he enjoy opera? Would he want wealth to support opera companies and so on? Now, perhaps somewhere you'll find some people who have totally run out of any further desire, perhaps. But then they have given up, I would say, any values to pursue. See, if we have, whoever has values left to pursue, if we're pursuing values in the physical world, wealth is the material means of pursuing them. Mr. Blair.
Your article, Education on the Racist Road with Barbara, I'd like to ask you a question related to that.
All right.
Okay, it appeared in the, it's kind of perfectly related, it appeared in the Freedman, but that's a journal that, I should say there's an edge to this question, but it's really the edge of curiosity, not suspicion.
Right.
It appeared in the Freedman, which often features articles which attempts to justify capitalism on religious grounds, even as recently as the July issue.
Yeah.
Personally, I'm glad it appeared there. It gave me an excuse to read it again. And anytime your writing can reach a wider audience, that's fine with me. But how do you reconcile it? Is there not a philosophical contradiction there, or is there something to be reconciled at all?
Is there a philosophical contradiction in having an article appear in a publication which also advocates values that are contrary to my own? I would say that one could not take that as a general principle. if you hold life as a standard, and you had said you will live by the principle of not dealing with anyone who holds any substantial philosophical contradictions, then I could not own an automobile, I could not buy food, I would have to live in self-sufficiency in a cave somewhere. I think you can deal with people who hold ideas opposed to your own, provided you are not advancing them in any way. And provided you're not advancing their irrationality. And you see, just think of the, suppose I had said, well, no, because the Freeman has certain religious ideas, I won't let an article appear there. Well, then, if the standard is achieving things in the real world, would that be a practical decision or not? I think I would be destroying my own ends. I'd be acting contrary to my own values. Yes.
Between your concept of free goods and economic goods,
yeah.
And you mentioned air as being one, and how would air become an economic good? For instance, would you establish private property over air? As for instance, it gets polluted slightly in cities, let's say, it becomes a value to have air clean factories or thereabouts, and then you would establish, how would you bridge between those things?
Well, air, atmospheric air, is not an economic good. Now, air can become an economic good. For example, oxygen in a submarine, the oxygen supply in a high-altitude airplane or a spacecraft, that is an economic good. If you're talking about economic goods in connection with acting on free goods, well, suppose, for example, you have a humidifier in your home, or you have an air conditioner or central heating. These are actual goods which we possess, which are dealing with the air around us. But air, the atmosphere as such, I don't think is subject to becoming private property. Now, a person could have private property rights extending upward, like you could have a right that an airplane cannot pass within a certain closeness to your home. But I don't see how we could make the air private property, or should. The lady in the back.
Well, how about something like radio waves? Would you be able to say that at that point, if you've established a certain right, should the air that you send the radio waves through, in the same way that you
Well, you can. I think you can have private property in radio waves, but that's not the atmospheric air. You have the right to transmit. You could acquire the right to transmit over a definite frequency.
So, if you want to hear the radio waves, it would be the waves themselves. If you were claiming that they were doing something to it, not the air that they went through.
Yeah, there's an article I think in Capitalism: The Unknown Ideal, the property status of airwaves, which goes into this issue very, very well.
Space that has no air, it's not the air, it's propagating
the radio waves. Okay, well, that, in effect, that's my own point. Thank you. Yes, this gentleman right back here in the green.
Yeah, you used the term praxeology.
Yeah.
From Von Mises, so I was wondering if you could elaborate on that. And I think you indicated that it's an invalid term.
Well, by praxeology, Von Mises means the theoretical science of human action. And he claims that economics is a part of this science, which rests on the proposition that every action people undertake seeks a psychic profit, that everything one does because one prefers to do it rather than any alternative. And he attempts to derive basic concepts of price and cost at this level, prior to any consideration even of actual exchange and money. For elaboration, I'd have to refer you to the opening chapters of Human Action. Yes, this gentleman. Yeah. All right, last question. Okay, this gentleman right over here. Yeah.
If wealth and economic goods are defined as the things that one needs in order to live your life in the practical day-to-day world, that's the general definition of such things. In those terms, I want to suggest that the intellectual ideas, theories, and philosophies, because they are essential, at least practical tools for living in the everyday world, they are they have a similar status to material goods, intellectual goods. And as an example, if I think of myself, I've invested a lot of time and resources in coming here, which I expect to assist me for living in the real world in the future. And I consider myself more wealthy in this sense. I've obtained this additional good. It may not be that easy to exchange, although intellectuals do make a career out of exchanging intellectual goods. So I think that it seems not correct to have that dichotomy between the material goods and the intellectual goods.
Yeah. All right. This question is very similar to one asked previously. You note the fact that human life depends on many intellectual accomplishments. And you assume that because more is necessary than material goods, that we should have only one general category. Now, your point goes against the division of sciences. You would seek to have one science which would somehow incorporate the body of economics and the totality of philosophy and everything else. You would have one undifferentiated mass which would attempt to deal with everything that is of value to human life. One part would be economics, another part would be medicine, a third would be philosophy, a fourth would be astronomy, whatever. I believe that a substantial portion of human knowledge can be differentiated on the basis of studying the production of wealth under a system of division of labor, and that that is what differentiates economics. Now, to say that wealth is material goods made by man is in no way, and I cannot imagine why anyone could believe that this in any way denigrates the value of ideas. The theme of my talk was that all of this depends on the fact that man is the rational being, that this is what gives him the need and desire for wealth without limit, that it's what enables him to produce more and more. So to say that we have a science which studies the production of wealth under a division of labor, and these things are wealth and those things aren't, that does not take away one iota of importance from any material and from any intellectual value. And you see, I think there's an element in this, something in common with the older notion that wealth is like too low to have its own full recognition. There's nothing low about wealth, and giving it its due recognition does not take anything away from any other value. On this note, I'll simply have to close.